Podo. You're listening to The Election Tricycle with Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin and Rohan Venkat.
Hi, and welcome back to The Election Tricycle. I'm Emily Tamkin, here with my co-hosts, Rohan Venkat.
Hello.
And Tom Hamilton.
Hello.
Every week, we take you on our little tricycle around the world to look at the elections of 2024, notably those in the United States, the United Kingdom, and India. As a reminder, if you are interested in listening to the full premium version of this podcast, you can do that either by signing up to my Substack, emilyctamkin.substack.com, or by going to tricycle.hubwave.net. Now, this week, we are going to talk about student protests, a huge story here in the United States, but also in India. But first, we have an update from Tom. Tom, over to you.
Yeah, there's been big news in the UK since we last spoke a week ago. Specifically, big news in Scotland, because the First Minister of Scotland slightly accidentally collapsed his own political career over the course of about 3 days without anyone expecting that to happen. It's fair to say that Humza Yousaf, there's a process to go through, the First Minister of Scotland, had not been doing particularly well. He was not particularly well placed in the opinion polls compared to where the SNP has been for some time. He was widely regarded as not doing a brilliant job, but nevertheless, his job was not under immediate threat. But he took an important and fateful decision, which backfired enormously. So to take a few steps back, the SNP were in government in a power-sharing agreement with the Green Party, the Scottish Green Party, because they didn't quite have enough seats for an overall majority. The system in Scotland is built so that it should be quite hard for any party to get an overall majority, so that's quite normal, and parties have had to form various different kinds of alliance. But after the 2021 election, the Bute House agreement between the SNP and the Greens were set up, and it meant that the Greens have got or had a couple of ministers in the Scottish government. A couple of weeks ago, the SNP government scrapped its target of cutting greenhouse gas emissions by 75% by 2030. It scrapped that target on the grounds that it was completely unachievable. It wasn't going to happen. So it wanted to recalibrate. We can have a separate argument about whether it was wise to set a target quite as ambitious as that. The Greens, who are obviously, the clue is in the name, quite keen on green-focused policies, were not very happy about this, and they said they were going to go away and have a vote on power sharing at some point in the next few weeks. Yousaf said that he was still committed to power sharing. He wanted that to continue. But then last Thursday, so less than a week ago, he unilaterally ended the power sharing arrangement, effectively kicked the two Green ministers out of government and said that they were no longer part of his plans. The Greens were understandably upset because this came a bit out of nowhere. And immediately, all the other parties started responding in ways that were unhelpful to Humza Yousaf, but should have been quite predictable. So the Scottish Conservative leader said that he was going to put forward a vote of no confidence in Yousaf personally in the Scottish Parliament. And all the other parties, including the Greens, said they were going to back it. And at that point, it became clear that Yousaf didn't have the votes. He clearly did not expect this to happen. He certainly clearly didn't expect the Greens to back him. We ended up in a situation where a party that only has one MSP, MSP is a member of the Scottish Parliament, one MSP, the ALBA party, which is sort of an SNP breakaway party led by Alex Salmond, the former SNP First Minister. They have one MP who's Ash Regan, who defected to ALBA after losing the SNP leadership election last year. She decided that she was not going to back him. She wrote a letter with various conditions, which was basically about an electoral pact with the SNP, which is something the SNP couldn't wear. They have a number of differences over various issues, notably trans issues, where the Scottish government, the Scottish SNP Green government, had a notably liberal policy around trans issues, more liberal than the rest of the UK, which has caused some controversy there. But anyway, it became clear over the weekend that this was not going well for Yousaf. And he said in a brilliant quote, he said, "I didn't mean and I didn't intend to make them as angry as they clearly are by kicking them out of the government." I mean, you know, this is a thing that does make politicians at least a bit upset.
At least a little angry.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you got basically unilaterally fired from your job, you might have an emotional response to that. And if you're a politician, a political response to that. So it became really clear by Monday morning, well, to be honest, over the weekend, that he couldn't win the vote of no confidence. And so he announced his resignation on Monday. And that's that. So there is now a Scottish National Party leadership election about to start. We don't yet have, I think, any declared candidates. The most likely runners are John Swinney, who has led the SNP before quite a long time ago, very long-serving politician, one of the sort of the older generation, would be seen as a bit of a sort of a caretaker leader, I think. And it's fairly clear that he doesn't really want it. And then Kate Forbes, who ran against Yusuf last time, didn't win, is a lot younger, is a bit more right wing, but she is quite fiscally conservative. She's also quite socially conservative. She's a devout Christian. She's clearly had significant differences with the party over the trans rights issue that I mentioned earlier, and on some other issues as well. And I think there are some concerns about what her leadership would do for broader questions around abortion, sexuality, things that she says that she wouldn't want to bring to the table, but which nevertheless the views of a leader are quite decisive in what legislation ends up happening. So that was a thing that people were concerned about. But it's not yet clear if she's going to win. The upshot of it in terms of the UK general election is it is vitally important for Labour that it wins a fair number of seats in Scotland. And the polls suggest that as things stand, they will. And that one of the reasons for that is the drop off in support for the SNP and Yusuf's failure to arrest that decline. I think the SNP have actually gone up slightly since he resigned. But clearly the fact that the SNP are in a bit of a mess doesn't do any harm to the various parties that are challenging them. So this is, broadly speaking, I think it's fair to say bad news for them and good news for their opponents. But more broadly, it's a story about long-term incumbency. They've been in office in Scotland for, I think, 17 years now. There are various areas where they can no longer blame anyone else for various kinds of policy failing, although that is something that they're trying to do.
And we have, if I'm not incorrect, we have new leaders in the UK, in England, in Scotland now, in Northern Ireland, and in Ireland proper, but that's another matter. I mean, it's quite a shift also going into the general.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I saw someone said this week that every single party that won a seat at the last general election in the UK Parliament, every single party has changed its leader since then. That hasn't happened since, I can't remember, possibly the 1950s, possibly earlier than that. It's a very unusual thing to happen for obvious reasons. So yes, it is all changed.
Both Emily and I are looking at, you know, that polity with stars in our eyes a little bit and being able to change leadership quite like that.
Yeah, yeah. One other bit of news from the UK that I should flag before we get onto the meat of our discussion is that we have local elections going on Thursday this week, which is to say quite a lot of local councils, quite a lot of what we call metro mayors, who are the mayors of larger urban and surrounding areas of the UK, including London. So they will be seen as an indication of how parties stand as we come up to a general election, which has to be held, expected this year, but has to be held by January next year.
Yeah, one quick question on that. I had read that if the Tories really did poorly in the local election, even though it doesn't impact the general election, that perhaps there could be a vote of no confidence for Sunak.
Well, it wouldn't be a vote of no confidence in a parliamentary sense.
No, sorry, I meant like his leadership would be challenged.
It is possible, and they're clearly worried about that. There are questions about whether that would be very sensible of anyone. They've changed Prime Minister twice already in this Parliament. Even though the current Prime Minister isn't doing brilliantly well, it's not obvious that anyone could do better at this point. But yeah, there has been some speculation that there might be an election as soon as July, partly just to head that off, which, you know, sounds a bit mad. And yes, if they had a really bad night, that could conceivably happen. A lot of the polls are suggesting that some of the really important metro mayoral elections, notably the one in the West Midlands and the one in Teesside, which are both Tory held, they could just about hold on in those areas, which, and it's really clear from the way that the Tories have done their expectation management, where they say, these are the results you should look out for, this is the big test, that that's the test they're setting. And when parties set that sort of test, it probably means that they're going to do all right.
Well, we are now going to turn to campus protests, and especially my alma mater, Columbia University. So here is what happened here in the U.S. And we'll, I promise we're not just going to talk about U.S. protests. Well, Tom and Rohan will get to speak as well. But 2 weeks ago, President Shafiq of Columbia University testified before Congress about anti-Semitism at Columbia. Now, you may remember 4 months ago, there was this disastrous hearing with the presidents of MIT, Harvard, and Penn, where they like hemmed and hawed about, is it against the rules to call for genocide against Jewish students? Like, they just were not prepared. She had this extra time to prepare and clearly decided, or was told, like, just, you know, the way you do this is that you say we have a problem. Here are specific steps that we're taking to fix it. You know, throw yourself at the mercy of the court. This upset faculty at Columbia, at least to whom I spoke after, because they said, well, what about academic freedom? Why are you inviting Congress to dictate to us how to run our campus? And also, it's, you know, their point was, it's not that there's no anti-Semitism here. Of course there is. But how does having this discussion help fix it? It did not only upset faculty in that as this was happening, students at Columbia set up an encampment on campus in solidarity with the people of Gaza and to demand that Columbia divest or withdraw its investments from companies that they say helps the Israeli military. They also said that they wanted to end the dual degree program with Tel Aviv University and end, you know, student exchanges with Israeli institutions. I think it was something like 30 hours after this went up, Shafiq calls in the riot police. Now, Columbia has a long history of activism. I do not know if it's because she was new to the school, or I'm not sure. But basically, there's the long legacy of 1968 and student protests and police storming the campus. And why you would dredge up that memory after day one.
Those were Vietnam protests, anti-Vietnam War protesters.
Exactly. Because there were some who jumped very quickly to say these protests are so anti-Semitic. And look, there were remarks from some of these protesters that were very clearly anti-Semitic. There were also some that it depends on what you consider anti-Semitism. So the phrase from the river to the sea. There are many Jews who are upset by that phrase and who think that means that you're trying to get rid of all of the Jews between these two bodies of water. There are some who say, okay, no, I understand that's a call for one state, but that would functionally mean the end of Jews in this region. And there are some who say, I have no problem with this at all. So basically what I am saying is that the university and politicians more generally are wading into a discussion about what constitutes anti-Semitism, in addition to how do we balance academic freedom and student safety. And the way that Shafiq decided to do this was by calling in the cops on day one. Obviously, this then escalated things because now other students come out to the lawn. Faculty had a walkout and were voicing their displeasure. And it also inspired other encampments around the country. Now, university presidents dealt with this very differently. There were some, like, for example, Wesleyan's President Roth said, okay, you know, don't, as long as it doesn't cross over into harassment of individual students, and as long as it's not violent, sure, protest, maybe you'll learn something. You know, the University of Chicago said, okay, as it is now, it's not that disruptive. Like, if you do X, Y, Z, perhaps it would cross over. For now, you can stay. Others, you know, other universities entered negotiations with protesters and said, okay, next year we'll look anew at our divestment, at our investment portfolio. Shafiq kept giving students deadlines by which they had to move, and these deadlines kept passing and the students were still there. Then the night before last, so Tuesday night, in the early hours of Tuesday morning, the students took over Hamilton Hall, which is not the first time Hamilton Hall has been overtaken. And this is a building on campus. Tuesday night, she calls the police back in to clear the encampment, clear the building. So I don't know as of yet what happens to the protests at Columbia. I do know that this has been a major story for the past 2 weeks. I know that images of police storming university campuses played on the news over and over again. I know that this war is unpopular. This war, you know, this is all because of students are unhappy with U.S. support for Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza. We know that that's unpopular with young people. I do not think that that watching their peers across the nation get yanked out of buildings or out of college campuses is going to help endear the president to young voters. And typically young voters vote Democratic. So, and also this has kept the issue at the forefront of the news as we, you know, so I think this is bad for Biden. I also just want to say, like, I don't think that this is helpful to the conversation around anti-Semitism and what constitutes anti-Semitic speech. I don't think that having Republican politicians who have used rhetoric that is, in my opinion, extremely anti-Semitic say we're so concerned about students that that's really helped anybody's safety. And further, I said this on Twitter last night and everyone got mad at me, so I'm going to say it again. I know that there were many American Jews who were deeply uncomfortable with what was being said at these protests because they support the war or because they don't support the war, but they said, well, what about October 7th? Or what about Hamas? Or what about, why is this the thing that you're protesting? It's always Israel, et cetera. I would just note that American Jews are also, and this is just speaking for myself, this is how I see this, American Jews are also a minority in this country. We have been kept safe in this country in part through robust pluralism, liberalism, and civil rights. When you support or cheer on police crackdown of a protest, and I understand in Colombia they took over a building. Like I do understand there's a difference between the encampment and the building, et cetera. But I think when you cheer that on, you are cheering down a crackdown of civil rights. And I would just remind everyone that the perhaps new president next year has reportedly allied with people who have said we're going to try to infuse the government with Christian nationalism. So like I understand that most American Jews are supportive of Israel. I understand that they don't like much of the language that was used, but for our own sake, if not for the principle of academic freedom and free speech, I would ask that we please think about this in a more robust way. Rohan, I wanted to, there was one interesting moment, I think it was last week, where there was an account, like a social media account that made viral this young woman. And he was like, what is she chanting? Like, what is this hate speech? And it was a young woman chanting Azadi, which is freedom, which is the cry out during protests against the Citizenship Amendment Act back in 2019, 2020, including by students. So universities are the sites, are also the site in India for protesting against government policy, but also, as I think we're seeing here, sort of attacks from those who like government policy, saying like, look at these radicals, look at these, you know, they're terrorists, they're this and this, they're so violent. So what, I mean, could you speak a bit about how, if at all, university protests are playing in your election?
Yeah, I mean, there's 100 thoughts that come up in this, partly because I'm also currently on a college campus in America. I'm at UPenn, where there's also an encampment where the demands are not just about, you know, the war in Gaza, but also the university's own connections to, as you mentioned, to Israel, particularly in this case, a company called Ghost Robotics and its involvement in defense. What jumps out to me most interesting, I mean, among the many things to think about here, is how different student politics are here. I went to university in the States as well, and this was around, you know, 2008, 2009, 2010, when the Occupy protests were also happening, and of course the Obama moment was happening. And what really jumps out to me as a difference between India is that student politics still seems quite divorced from the broader political structure. In India, these things are very much closer connected. The parties and positions on campus are the political parties that contest in elections. Of course, they're a bit more liberal on campus. And so JNU, the Jawaharlal Nehru University in Delhi, which is what you were referring to, is known as this bubble, this bastion of very leftist thought, not just in Delhi, but in India broadly, because it is India's premier postgraduate institution. And it was the site of big protests, first in 2016, when we had very similar sites where police went on campus to arrest a student leader who, at the time, the government was claiming was using seditious language, even though it seemed doctored. And then in 2019, 2020, over the Citizenship Act protests, when it was less police action and more mobs empowered by the government, by the right-wing parties, But yeah, what really strikes me, aside from the actual issue at hand here, is just the more structural idea of politics. In India, a lot of political leaders come out of student politics. A lot of the folks who have, you know, the big protest that took on Indira Gandhi during the emergency in 1977 was a student movement. It starts there. And student politics creates a lot of, like, burnishes a lot of the early careers of politicians. Whereas here, it's interesting to me that it's almost its own little space, and then it's looked upon by everyone outside with a lot of commentary.
Right. I think what's interesting about this is that it both is and isn't connected to national politics, in that I think it's getting so much attention because it was tied to this congressional hearing, because politicians from all over have come, especially not only to Colombia, to comment on it. I also think, you know, I've seen some people say, like, the students aren't going to end the war. And it's like, well, no, they don't have that power, but they're clearly upset by the war and are trying to use the levers of power that they do have, which are about their university.
And the Democratic Party is not, I mean, the two parties, neither of them are taking on that as a mass issue.
Right. And I think an interesting thing is that the College Democratic Association, the College Democrats, like the nationwide College Democrats, came out against Biden's policy and in support of the protesters. This is not the national policy of the Democratic Party, which was still with, like, Biden came out multiple times to condemn, to condemn the protesters. And many Democrats as well as Republicans have come out and chastised the protesters. So I think we're seeing not only a distance between university politics and national politics, but also a big generational divide here.
I was interested in the question of just in terms of seeing how this has been playing out on my Twitter feed, right? As someone who's, I haven't been commenting on it myself because it's not something that I know enough about, but I've seen basically a balance of people saying this crackdown is awful and what these students are doing is to be commended, and what's happening in Gaza is something they should be protesting against, and all the messages that you mentioned earlier. And there's also quite a lot of people pointing at particular instances of the students saying things that you might say are a bit silly, a bit self-indulgent. Some of that is anti-Semitism, but actually some of it is more generalized leftist studentness of a kind that they do look as if they're a bit disconnected from the real world and some of what they're saying. And I was wondering about A, how is the balance of that playing? And B, is there a risk that plays out badly for Biden, basically in both directions, because you get the people who are upset at heavy-handed action against protesters, but you also get people who are more generally associating student protesters with the left in general, of whom Biden is still a part, and saying, well, look at these daft people. You don't want these people anywhere near power.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that they call, like, just as Shafiq, by calling the police, but also the protests were still going on, she made everybody mad. Because those on the left said, why did you call in the police? And those on the right said, it's still going on. Similarly, I think everybody will be mad about it. Everybody will be upset with Biden's handling of this, wherever you are on the political spectrum. On the individual incidents, yeah, I think that's had a huge influence on how this has been shown in the media. I think I talked about this last week about the sort of difference between student accounts and student reporting and national reporting on this issue. The ACLU came out with guidelines which basically said discipline conduct, not content, and individual instances. So if, you know, when something crosses over into harm to another, as opposed to, hey, that speech was very offensive to me, that's conduct, not content. And also when it's directed to one student or one set of students, like, you're the individuals with whom I'm taking up my issues, as opposed to here's my general foreign policy. That was the ACLU guideline. Obviously, in my opinion, that is not a guideline that many have chosen to follow. And I think centrist and right-wing types for the last 4 years, I think, have really been the ones saying free speech is under attack. This cherished American political value that people don't care anymore. It's everything is so policed. And I think here it's sort of flipped. And obviously, that's because actually nobody is a free speech absolutist. People like the policies that they like to be allowed to be expressed. But it will be interesting to see how that scrambles politics ahead of the election. I don't see how it scrambles anything well for Biden.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. I think the other point about how does it play for national politics, going back to the 1968 question again, where you had Vietnam protests And then you had, in a not completely unconnected way, although it wasn't by any means the only issue that people were voting on, but you did then get, you know, Nixon in power for some time. And you know, the resurgence of the right in American politics, where, you know, part of the language of the right in that area was, you know, look at these long haired hippie students, and you don't want those people anywhere near influence. And I saw someone make a very good point today that, you know, in the end, that's not what these protests are for. Those students were protesting about the Vietnam War, and they did slowly get what they wanted, actually. These people are protesting about Gaza, and they could be right or they could be wrong about what they're protesting about, but they are not trying to, their main motivation is not to influence the election in the US this autumn. Their main intention is to change policy in relation to this particular issue. And there's a danger of, I worry a bit about telling people they shouldn't do things they care about, because of the long-term knock-on effect it might have on an election that is not their primary purpose. People are allowed to get upset about things in the world and protest about them. I'm allowed to agree or disagree with them as I like, but it's a slightly separate issue. And I this is partly the nature of, you know, this is the Election Tricycle. We're talking about elections. That's our main purpose as a podcast. But this is not about the election.
Right. This is not about the election. You do have some who will say, don't you realize this is hurting Biden? What is it? Do you want Trump to win? Don't you realize that Trump is the worst alternative? And look, I mean, obviously I agree that Trump is the worst alternative, but that doesn't mean that people can't or aren't allowed to take to their college campuses because they're ashamed and horrified that tens of thousands of people have been killed in Gaza with US backing. The fact that there is an election does not mean that people have to stop having opinions about foreign policy and shouldn't express their views on that foreign policy. And again, you can disagree or disagree with the protests, with how they're expressing it, with how I just described, you know, their version of current events. But politics do not stop and start with the election, but politics do bleed into the election.
There's another element that resonates beyond America, not just, as you said, Tom, in terms of, you know, the hippie student protester who creates a caricature of leftist politics. But I think from afar, what I'm seeing from out of a lot of India is you know, we in India get all these lectures when we crack down on dissent here, and look, it's happening in America, and you know, European leaders aren't going to America and talking about democratic backsliding and lecturing the Americans on this. Maybe some of it is happening, whatever, but it's clearly not the same tone and tenor as versus when it happens in India. So in a way, it empowers populists everywhere to say, look, they do it when it's an issue that matters to them, and the double standards of this at large, it's a very strong message, and you can see the right in India really embracing that.
Well, and I think, you know, Biden came into office and talked about marrying domestic policy and domestic politics and democracy with democracy and foreign policy. And I think, you know, if you're going to say that, then you're setting yourself up to be held to a different standard. And I remember, you know, when I was reporting on it back at the time, people were like, I don't know how you're going to lecture India about democracy when you guys just had January 6th. But Biden's president this time, right? Like, that actually was not him. This is under his watch. And I think some young people will say, well, with his encouragement, because of the statements that he put out were so critical of the protests and the protesters. So, I think that's absolutely right, Ron. And I think, what is the U.S. going to say? Oh, it's different because it's us? Like...
At the same time, just what jumps out to me is the fact that these are the elite, the Ivy League campuses. These are not the fact that some of that it's happening here. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, although it's also at University, I mean, we've been talking about Columbia and Penn. It's also happening at University of Texas and UCLA and it's City College, New York. So the elite campuses get the sort of most prominent campuses get the most attention. But this has happened at private schools, state schools, small schools, big schools.
Yeah, the reason I bring it up is more just there's also this caricature of the elite university students as not caring about politics and being a bit, you know, in their own little bubbles. And that the fact that this is happening at places like Harvard and Columbia and UPenn is also striking to a different audience.
One thing that's quite striking about the way this is playing out in the UK is that although there are some student protests here, they're not, I don't want to denigrate the people involved, but they are not important in the national conversation. We're not really hearing about them. And to the extent that we're hearing about protests about Gaza at all, it is more about the mainstream. They will have students on them, but the mainstream public protests, particularly in London, but in other cities. And the biggest debate about them is, apart from the substance of the Gaza issue, is about the fact that the police are not cracking down on them. They are broadly letting them happen. And there are many people, especially on the right, who would like to see them crack down on a lot more than they are. Various former Tory, former Home Secretaries have said that they should be banned and they haven't been banned. There's no suggestion that they will be banned anytime soon. But it's just interesting that the politics of that are playing out in quite a different way. And I must say, I'm uncomfortable with banning marches and certainly uncomfortable with sort of quasi-military responses to protests.
But I did this event on, I did a panel on anti-Semitism last night here, so Tuesday night here in DC, and I was asked, basically, is there any way to win if you're an outside institution or if you're a politician? Because again, you're being asked to wade into a conversation of what constitutes anti-Semitism, which and what constitutes hate speech and what constitutes permissible speech, which even people who are ostensibly the target of that, i.e. Jews, like we don't agree on that. And the short answer is no, like, no, there isn't a way to win. But somebody will be upset in your handling of this because the population itself that you're ostensibly protecting does not agree. To say nothing of like Muslim Americans and Arab Americans, Palestinian Americans, and people who are none of these things, but feel strongly about these issues and the war. But you can try to have consistent policies and principles and act within those policies and principles. We have to leave this there. We are going to go to our new segment, Tricycle Recommends, in which each of us shares something that we have enjoyed or enjoyed reading or that has made us think. I'll go first since I'm already talking. This is on the subject. It's by Edward Luce in the Financial Times, and it's Adults, Not Students, Are America's Problem. Ooh. So we'll put that in the show notes. I recommend it. It took a very different tone than a lot of the coverage of these protests and of the discussion.
Yeah. I'm going to recommend a piece from News Minute and News Laundry, two publications in India, by Shubham Gautam, Ishita Pradeep and Saeed Zaman. This is a piece where what they did was just examine coverage of issues in the lead up to the elections on the major TV anchors. The debates basically that they were having over the last month or so. And it's a very good way of depicting to those who are not familiar and even those who live in India and know the elections, how much the media has become a mouthpiece of the government. What they found is that 52% of the topics chosen for the main debate were a way to bash the opposition. And you would imagine, you know, speaking truth to power, this is a weak opposition even, right? And yet more than half and only something, another 27% or so were promoting the government and how great it was and so on. And there's only about 1% or so that they find on substantive issues like unemployment or inflation and so on. So as you said, we link to it, but it's a useful documentation of things we know about not just the politicians, but the media environment playing its role in where India is today.
And I'm going to recommend a piece by Blair McDougall on his Substack. Blair is, he formerly ran the campaign against Scottish independence in the referendum in 2014. And he's now a Labour candidate and he writes about Scottish nationalism from an anti-nationalist perspective and also in terms of strategy. And he's written a really interesting piece on the big strategic mistakes that Humza Yousaf has made in his time in office, rather than the sort of short-term tactical things that we spoke about at the start of the podcast. So always worth reading, I think, about how to think about messaging and strategy in relation to Scottish politics in particular.
All right. Regular listeners, we have to leave it there. Premium listeners, sit tight. Regular listeners, you could always become a premium listener by going to either my Substack, emilyctamkin.substack.com, or by going to tricycle.hubwave.net. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you'll tune in next week.
The The Election Tricycle is a Poddo podcast hosted by Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin and Rohan Venkat. It is series produced by Nick Hilton. Tweet us at Tricycle2024 and watch a video version of the show at cooler.news. For sales and advertising, please email nick@podopods.com. podopods.com.